Facebook, Google, all of these companies are trying to figure out where are the rules and where are they going to draw the line.
There's clearly a demand for renters. They've got most of them full.
If you own a bond in your retirement portfolio, the price of that is going to go down.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Glink, sitting in for Steve this afternoon and tomorrow as well. You can find me online at LinkedIn or Instagram or Facebook. We're going to be talking about all of these different websites in just a moment with Joan Solzman. Bestmoneymoves.com is my employer-facing financial stress reduction company, tech company, and thinklink.com, of course. So, a lot of news today about Slack going public and the end in 7 years, they predict, of email, which is all kinds of crazy stuff that you wonder how anybody ever lived without email, and now we all can't wait to get rid of it. Slack wants to be that solution, but there's some questions about how you moderate something like that, how you actually think about it. Joan Solzman is the senior writer at CNET. Hey, Joan, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hi.
Hi there. So, you know, clearly Slack is sort of the big tech story of the day, but there are also, you've got a story online this morning also about Democrats and Republicans splitting over social media content. And we still, I think, have Nancy Pelosi upset because Facebook won't remove that, what she calls fake news of her looking like she's drunk image on YouTube and in other places that's popped up. What do you guys think about that? When you've done your research, what came up?
Well, what we've seen, there's a new report out of the Pew Research Center that shows that generally most people think that social media companies should remove offensive content, but not many people are confident that social media companies are actually capable of doing it. And there are differences between people that lean Republican and those that are Democrat in their kind of attitudes about how hands-off or aggressive those social media companies should be.
So that's interesting. So what do the Democrats think, and then what do the Republicans think?
So more Democrats believe that social media companies have a responsibility to remove offensive content, whereas Republicans, they're more evenly split. So there are more Republicans that tend to believe social media companies should be more hands-off. And then Democrats are also slightly more confident that social media companies can deliver on determining what should be removed, whereas Republicans, they aren't as confident.
What do you think? Because I know that Facebook is looking at an independent board to handle appeals for content decisions. There's been a number of stories about, from quoting people who are part of the Facebook editorial content team, it sounds horrific, those jobs. Do you think that they're capable? Doesn't it, right? Do you think that Facebook and YouTube and, you know, all these other social media sites, do you think they're actually capable of making a sound decision?
If you look at their track records so far, the answer is a resounding no. And that's because they've gotten themselves into a situation where all of these social media companies, and not just social media companies, many tech companies, the prioritization is always growth at a lot of costs, maybe not all costs, but many costs. And one of the costs of growth, especially at social media companies, is the ability to moderate content on the scale that they've reached. When we're talking about Facebook, it's 2.7 billion monthly active users. It's a scale of moderation that nobody has ever really had to encounter before. When you couple that with this attitude that's intrinsic to the internet and the foundations of these companies, that they aren't arbiters of truth and they don't exert any sort of editorial judgment, that's how we've gotten into the situation where these companies really aren't equipped and they're kind of grappling to figure out what to do to moderate offensive content, illegal content, and stuff that falls into all these gray areas that's really difficult for algorithms and computers to figure out.
Well, it's true. I mean, I have a son who's in AI, at artificial intelligence, and we've had this conversation frequently because there is a, you know, people express themselves in very interesting and unusual ways, and context is a huge part of that, and artificial intelligence really isn't smart enough yet. in order to be able to make those kinds of snap decisions in real time. And a lot of it, you know, the algorithms that have already been built have been shown to have intrinsic bias because of the people who have actually been programming them. And so you end up in a situation where if you're looking at the technology to regulate hate speech, for example, or some of the other offensive content that's out there, and yet the technology isn't advanced enough to keep up, what do you do in the meantime?
In the meantime, Facebook and others, YouTube as well, they have said, well, artificial intelligence, machine learning, isn't at the point where it can replicate the breadth of context that a human can do. So we're just going to add more humans. We'll bulk up a giant army of moderators, and that's how we're going to tackle this problem, which, you know, sounds
good.
The logical way to solve the problem.
Sure.
But that's where we get into this difficulty where we have often people working for third-party companies, not in-house Facebook workers, doing the moderation of truly traumatic stuff day in, day out. And that's where we're seeing some of the reporting about people having PTSD symptoms, other dramatic health and mental and physical health effects by being a moderator of some of the worst things people put on the internet.
Well, another story you have on site today is about car data privacy. And I think that people don't really think about this, that their cars track. If you've got, a car that can give you a map in it, that's got enough of a technology piece to do that, which every single new car does, and
right.
Even those that are 5, 6, 7 years old. So most of the cars out there in the market can actually track your movements with pretty great detail. I mean, you might want to check out NCIS and see exactly what they can do with that. But now the data privacy, I don't think people have really thought about that. So what did your story find? I know there's a big case with the Georgia Supreme Court right now.
Yes, in Georgia, there's a state Supreme Court case that's being heard. It's something that the ACLU is pursuing specifically to establish a precedent as our cars become, when we look towards a not-too-distant future of self-driving cars becoming more automated. As we look towards a future where our cars collect even more data about who we are, where we go, and what we're doing, that police must get a warrant in order to access that information. Right now, as it stands, cars have, what we call the black box, which is normally used for crash analysis, making sure that your car, when you had this devastating car accident, was going 45 miles per hour and not 97 miles per hour in the zone that it wasn't supposed to. But as you said, because cars are becoming increasingly technological, any infotainment system you have in your car that connects your smartphone to it, the car is also collecting all that data, your phone's contacts, the songs you listen to. And as it is right now, there's no clear laws or precedent about whether or not police need a warrant in order to get all that data when they're accessing any of the data from a car's computer or black box.
Yeah, I think that people really underestimate when you connect to something. And I just deleted an entire account on Alignable, actually, yesterday because I, accidentally, without meaning to, because I'm very careful about this, I actually accidentally connected my Gmail to it. And suddenly it was like they were reading all of my data, and I just immediately deleted the account. And I think people just aren't aware that how quickly the data flows and what you need to be thinking about when you're making those connections.
Yeah, it's really showing the flip of a coin in our perception about convenience of technology versus the privacy implications of it. For a long time, our technology has been touted as we interconnect it more, that brings you more convenience. But in the last few years, we've really seen a heightened sensitivity to the privacy implications. When you have all those interconnected technological elements, how many different nodes of the corporate world and the technological world know all these different things about you because of that interconnectivity.
Yeah, it's really important to think about. Joan, thank you so much for being with us. We'll check in with you again next week.
Thank you.
Joan Solzman is a senior writer at CNET, and you can find these stories and a bunch of other ones that we didn't even have time to at CNET.com. Hey, welcome back, everybody. I'm Elise Glink here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, sitting in for Steve today and tomorrow. Glad you could join us here. Right now, Celeste Adams, who's president and CEO of the Frank Lloyd Wright Trust, joins us on the line. Celeste, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Elise. Glad to be with you.
So Frank Lloyd Wright's home and studio is getting a new makeover, or a new visitor center, rather?
Well, we are announcing plans for a new visitor and education center. This has been a long time coming. In 2015, our immediate adjacent neighbor inquired if we were interested in purchasing the property. That took a while for that transaction, and by the end of 2017, we had acquired the property. And then there was a decision about an architect to design the expansion. And John Ronan was chosen as the architect, and now we are announcing the first concept design for a new visitor and education center. So it's a very exciting week for us.
All right. So I just have to say that if you are the architect to build something, you know, to honor Frank Lloyd Wright, you just got to be a little nervous about that, right?
Well, I think John Ronan is a very well-known Chicago architect, the architect of the Poetry Foundation. He understands the significance of the site and has created a concept design that is quiet in character, respectful of its surroundings, and yet has a power of presence of its own.
So I really love the Poetry Building. What does this one look like?
We'll have it on our website today with the renderings. We have images of the concept design. It is a brick and glass building, one story, that fits very gracefully into the site and will be a new chapter for the Trust in terms of our ability to welcome visitors more easily. Right now, the Frank Lloyd Wright Home and Studio sits behind a wall. It's a bit sequestered. And with this new design, there will be an open lawn leading into the visitor center, which will allow for much more ease of access and our ability to move people through the site much more easily, and more importantly, to have a more profound educational impact on the people who visit.
Right. And so I understand that the project's going to have a conference room, you've talked about the plaza, but classrooms. How many people come? You know, professionals come to study or to do conferences at your facility, or do you expect will with the new building? And I know students, you've got loads and loads of students who come through every year. Tell me a little bit about what this will enable you to do.
We do. We have 90,000 visitors a year to the site and operate many programs on the site, and we have been in the Chicago public schools for many decades. But we have always had a limitation to our facility. Without a visitor center or a proper conference center or studio where children can work, we have been limited in terms of what we can offer on site. And we want visitors and residents of the neighborhood and the area to feel that this is a learning center, a valuable resource for them to learn about the history of great architecture in their neighborhood, but also allow for education of the next generation, for children coming to the site, learning creative, indulging in their own creativity, exploring their own capacity to grow as artists.
Are you concerned at all just, you know, from a real estate perspective? I know there's been some turnover in Frank Lloyd Wright houses. A well-known one sold, I think it was this year, maybe last year, out in the Hinsdale area. And then you've got a whole bunch on the North Shore that, you know, seem to not be in demand, shall we say, anymore. And there's been some litigation over the expansion plans for some. Are you concerned about the homes and the legacy and how hard, difficult they are to maintain in a proper way?
We aren't, because we have in Oak Park a very unique culture. There are 32 Frank Lloyd Wright homes and buildings in that neighborhood, which makes it the largest concentration of Wright's built work anywhere in the world. So the neighborhood is very unique, and people living there are conscious of the value of this legacy. And we work with the community very closely on programming and building awareness of the importance of the architecture in the Oak Park River Forest area.
And what about the collection of homes that are on the North Shore in Glencoe, for example?
Well, the Frank Lloyd Wright built in the course of his career about 1,000 projects, of which 500 were built. About half were never realized. Of the 500 built projects, about 350 remain. Over 85 of those are in the greater Chicago area. So an enormous number of Wright properties are in this area. This is clearly the place to, the great destination, the place to come if you want to discover the work of Frank Lloyd Wright. The fact that many of those homes are privately owned is a great tribute to people in the area who recognize that they are stewards of this legacy. People who purchase Frank Lloyd Wright homes don't do so as an investment. They do this because of their appreciation of Wright and dedication to perpetuating his legacy. And for an organization like ours, dealing with a great historical figure, we are always grappling with the issue of how to keep Wright's philosophy current with interests and values today. But an architect or an artist who rises to the level of Wright, it's not a difficult task to relate his achievement to young people growing up now.
Well, we are very much looking forward to seeing the facility finished. At first, it has to be started, but to be seeing it finished as well. And
it is a challenge ahead, but a wonderful challenge.
Well, we'll look forward to taking a tour when it's all done. Celeste Adams, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Glink, filling in for Steve Bertrand. You can find me online at bestmoneymoves.com or thinklink.com or linkedin.com or instagram.com or Facebook or almost everywhere else. And you can find my good friend and colleague, Dennis Rodkin, real estate reporter at Crane Chicago Business at chicagobusiness.com. Anywhere else, Dennis?
Well, on Twitter, I'm Dennis Rodkin.
Oh, and I'm at Glink. So there you go.
Oh, there we go.
There's so many ways for us to talk to each other, and yet this is the place we seem to do the most of it.
This is the place. It's true.
All right. So we were just talking in the break about the crazy real estate market here in Chicago. I'm so sick of reading how, I hate to say this, but I'm so sick of reading how great other markets are doing. Aren't you?
No, because it actually cheers me up, because I spent so much time covering how poorly our market is doing. And it's always important to say how poorly most of our market is doing, because
right.
we do have the hot neighborhoods, and there's been a little air let out of them in recent months, but they still are doing well by comparison to some of the suburban areas and the south suburbs and things like that.
Yeah, it does seem to be that the inner downtown Chicago area and some of the near north side neighborhoods are doing pretty well. And the near west side, we're seeing some good stuff. But it's nowhere near, by comparison, what we're seeing ongoing on in other places. And I follow your column all the time. And I see, you know, the reports daily almost, so-and-so sold for less than they bought 20 years ago.
It is actually every day I put at least one on Twitter. I don't always write a full story. Yesterday I did, and we'll talk about that one. But one of the things that people, you know, people say, oh, you're just looking for the negative news. But I'm not.
Right.
I see everything that sells in a day. I have a feed, and I don't have to search to find at least one property that has sold at a greatly reduced price. The one I tweeted today was a house in Lake Forest where the people bought it new in 1990,
yeah.
29 years ago.
Oh my gosh.
And they just sold it for less than they paid for it in 1990.
And you got to wonder how much they put into it in 30 years.
Right.
Because
over time,
I'm sure they did something to it.
Right. And that generation, I don't know how old those sellers were, but the generation of people who were sort of in their prime home buying years in the 1990s, they never saw home prices go down from World War II forward.
No.
They go down a little, but not the way we've seen. And what's going on now is not so much prices going down as failing to come up.
Yes.
There's just this sort of long, low line of growth. So I bought my house in 1990, and over the years I have redone the kitchen, put in a patio, regular maintenance on mm-hmm. the roof, the furnace, etc. And all of that is money that I don't get back. And that's not what you see in other markets. I don't really think there's another reporter in a big city who is my counterpart who's seeing this.
No, nobody else is seeing that. I know, because I cover the national news,
right.
And I'm, you know, about to go next week to the National Association of Real Estate Editors annual conference, where I'm going to sit there and listen to the mortgage bankers, you know, economist and the chief economist of Freddie Mac and the chief economist of Fannie Mae talk about how superb things are. And yet there's interesting stuff that's going on. So to get to some more, we can beat this dead horse for a little while longer.
Well, let's talk about the one. Let's talk about Governor Thompson, if we can.
Sure. And that's a great example of it. So.
It's the greatest illustration, I think. It's an unusual illustration in its own way, but it also works well as an example of what's happening. So former Governor James Thompson and his wife Jane bought a condo on North Michigan Avenue on Delaware over 10 years ago, and they've just sold it Friday for less than they paid for it, but for slightly less, 3% less than it went for in 2000 when it was brand new. So that's 19 years and two sellers. And so I was able to call him, and he was, you know, he's spoken.
And to be fair, let's say that if he just bought it a little over 10 years ago, he might have bought it what might have been the height of the market, right? He could have bought in 08, right? 11 years ago, which, it depending when Chicago started to really go down, could have been, you know, the end of the bang up years here.
Yeah.
Or at least on the slight downturn, but you still thought you were getting a good deal.
Nevertheless, to sell for below where it went in 2000, this country is built on in the 20th and 21st centuries has really run on an always expanding economy. I mean, or the notion of. And so he said, look, you know, he said two things. It's a different market than it was in 2000, and that is absolutely true. And he also said, we didn't update it, and neither did the people before us, so it's got 19-year-old finishes. And so he said the next owner got a good deal, but will need to spend money to bring it up to date. And I was thrilled that he said that, because one of the things that a lot of sellers don't get that you see all the time and that I put in stories all the time is that done sells, new sells, to get it sold at a good price, you've really got to get it in modern condition, got to get it made for today, not be in love with your finishes from 2000 or 1995 or whatever it is. And he said, we hadn't done it. The people before us hadn't done it. So you're buying a 19-year-old condo. I don't know why he didn't do it. I mean,
Well, it's kind of a pain in the neck to actually do your kitchen. It's a big upheaval. And you might spend between $50,000 and $80,000 to do a house like that.
He's certainly intelligent enough to know that he might have gotten that money back. But he also, I mean, you know, they had moved to another place. I can't speak for that because he didn't want to talk about that.
Well, timing is, you know, so he made that trade-off. And I think the trade-offs are super important. And I think, to your point, people don't think enough about, they look at that top-line number and they think, I have to get this, so I need to price it at that. And the broker is going to take X, and so I need X plus, and it's completely the wrong way to look at this market here in Chicago.
Because the market is going to say, your home is worth Y.
Right.
I don't care what X was or what the broker wants or anything else. The market today is here, and you start here and figure it out from there.
You know, one of the things that I always am asked as we're leading up to a presidential election year, which is what next year is, is what's going to happen to the real estate market? Because traditionally, you see a slowdown 9 months in advance of the actual election because there's so much consternation about where things are going. And I think on top of it right now for Chicago, you have this uncertainty about the state of Illinois, about what J.B. Pritzker is going to be doing as the new governor, Lori Lightfoot, what she's going to be doing as the new mayor. I mean, there's just a huge amount of change and turnover, which can be good energy, for a real estate market. And we've gotten some... We've missed some things, like we missed Amazon, you know, HQ2, but we have Google and we've got some other pieces that are coming in. How does that, do you think, play out? And how, more importantly for the suburbs, do you think the loss of major employers, you know, moving downtown is changing what was always a driving factor in the upward mobility of those home prices?
Well, I think one of the things to consider about next year's presidential election is that interest rates may be a whole different ballgame. Mortgage interest rates may be a whole different ballgame. We know that the president is saying that he said he would like a level playing field, right? He would like to see interest rates cut. When they started going up in, what would that be, November 2018, I guess, toward the end of last year, people were saying, oh, no, interest rates are going to get to 5%.
Oh, God, I've heard that for the last 10 years.
I can't buy a house.
Hello. So,
but they've come back. They never did hit 5, and they've come back down and come back down. And now the president, as we know, is saying that he would like them to come down, or suggesting that he would like them to come down further. We don't know exactly what will happen over the course of the next several Fed meetings. And that could certainly figure into the presidential election more than it has before. If we've got super low, amazingly low, never before seen interest rates, and the Trump economy continues to boom in the ways that it's booming, then the housing market may not pause. Who knows? We don't know.
I don't know. I don't think
a possibility.
It is. And we'll have to talk more about this. We have to take a quick break and do the Wintrust Minute. But there is a lot more to talk about in terms of whether Chicago will even respond to that kind of interest rate. Because as you and I both know, the difference between 3.9% and 3.5%, it's pretty irrelevant.
Right.
All right. We'll talk more with Dennis Rodkin, real estate reporter at Crane Chicago Business, in a moment. Right now, the Wintrust Minute.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. Hi, want to feel old? Generation Z is entering the workforce, and that means your potential coworkers could have been born between 1997 and 2012. I think I got gray hairs just from hearing that. With this big shift in the workforce means adjusting preferences in the workplace as well. Office designers and commercial real estate experts are seeing an uptick in usages of privacy phone booths in the office. Nope, won't have a phone in there. You also won't find Clark Kent using it to change into a supersuit. They're just little quiet escapes to privacy. A strange growing trend indeed. And another notable change is going on over at Rush Medical Center, and that is the shutting down of their inpatient mental health offerings for children. It wasn't the biggest part of their adolescent health care, but to have it as an option one day and gone the next will be significant to a handful of people. But thankfully, there is no shortage of hospitals in Illinois. So doing your research and finding the right one for you is the best way to go about it. No hospital deserts here. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Elise Klink, sitting in for Steve Bertrand, and I've got my good friend Dennis Rodkin, real estate reporter at the Crane Chicago Business, chicagobusiness.com, sitting here with me. We've had such a great chat during the commercial break about houses and selling. So we're going to turn to something a little even more unbelievable than how hard it is for people to sell in the North Shore. So there are plans afoot for a 37,000-square-foot Lincoln Park dream house.
Yeah.
Really, this is not a commercial building that you just kind of missed somehow?
No, although, yeah, exactly. It's a commercial building.
Wait, is it the size of a small Target?
Yeah, it would be. Yes, it would be. So this is a, there's a developer who does a lot of the really big houses in Lincoln Park, BGD&C. They've built several of the big ones people see there in the blocks immediately south of Lincoln Park High School, and they had a 4-lot site that they were offering, and then they managed to get a deal with the owner of the 5th lot, and so they said, well, now we could build you a 37,000-square-foot house on this 5-lot property, and that would start at about $25 million.
Okay. I don't even know where to start with, you know, why? Why? Maybe that's the best question here. Why does anybody need a 37,000-square-foot house unless you had like 42 children?
Well, if you have 42 children, that's one thing. But the other, so one of the things he pointed out is,
it's not like a 3-bedroom thing, is it?
Well, yeah.
It's a 37,000-square-foot, one-bedroom apartment.
Exactly. Well, so one of the things is, what he suggested is that a lot of people, as that part of Lincoln Park has evolved into this area where these very large multi-lot mansions are being built. It's been going on for 20 years, but as it has evolved, people have started to say, well, the thing I lack when I do this is the suburban style yard. So this lot could hold 37,000 square feet, but you might build only, let's say, 10,000 and have a very large yard around you. One nearby in that neighborhood did something similar and as a result, or possibly as a result, sold very quickly. So the idea is that the lot is capable of holding 37,000 square feet. That doesn't mean that's what you'd build.
Gosh, let's hope not. I mean, so the land alone, they said, was worth $12 million, or
worth
they spent
about 12.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, 5 lots in really the most expensive part of Lincoln Park. So, yeah, that's about where it would be.
Okay. So if you've got your pennies, nickels, and dimes in a jar, just keep saving.
That's got to be a very big jar.
Very, very big jar. Well, how about a big jar for this one, the $45,000 a month rental? I mean, do people think we're living in Los Angeles?
I think
or San Francisco
might.
Well, or New York City?
This company that has this $45,000 rental has high-end rentals in Los Angeles and San Francisco and Vancouver.
Do.
So they... it's fascinating to me because, you know, we've got all these luxury apartment buildings coming, and each one, or nearly every one, puts a big penthouse on top and says, we're going to rent this for $12,000. We're going to rent this for $15,000. Well, $30,000. This developer upped the ante to $45,000. This is a building on Wells, 1140 North Wells in Old Town, replacing the old Atrium Village apartments.
Okay.
And the penthouse.
Do you want to live on Division and Wells, though? I mean, that's really where it is.
It's different from what it once
was. Good drinking, you know, you can just go downstairs, basically, and there's like 12 bars.
If you want to leave your outdoor pool, don't forget, this rental has its own outdoor pool.
I saw that picture on Chicago Business and your story. It looked more like an outdoor bathtub. It's very small.
There is also an outdoor shower.
There's an outdoor shower hot tub.
For multiple people. It's not
exhibitionists
really,
apply here.
Yeah, it's sort of like a hangout pool. It's got, you know, benches around it and stuff. It doesn't like it doesn't have the infinity thing so you can swim against the current, but it is a pool. So I don't know that you'd ever end up out on Division Street because everything is in this apartment. Multiple bars. I mean, it's quite a place.
Is this building one of those buildings that would provide food service? They've got, you know, the laundry, the dry cleaning, all of those concierge services that are now sort of the We Live phenomenon.
Yeah.
You know, congregate rooms, party rooms, things like that.
This has all of that. It has a huge amenity floor with pools and gyms and things like that. And they also say at this $45,000 level, they will make a deal with you. You know, I want my own sheets. I don't want the rental sheets or whatever it would be. I want a butler, that sort of thing. They'll work with you because if you're at that level, you know, you're probably going to upsell a little or up buy, I guess, a little bit. So they'll bring in pretty much whatever you want.
I guess it's good to know, reassuring that there are people who have the means to spend $45,000 a month in rent. Do we think that it might be for a celebrity from LA who's coming here to shoot some movie or TV show?
Yeah, I think that's what would happen. So the developer told me that he is confident. He, you know, this is not, you don't just build this as a show place and say, well, maybe I'll rent it someday. You build it expecting that you actually can get it sold, rented, filled. And he's confident that he can because what he said is there's a real talent pool of CEOs and C-suite executives. There are also, of course, athletes who come and, you know, I arrive, I'm playing for the Bulls. I don't know how long I'm going to be here. I may not buy. But
corporate apartments of some sort.
But at the $45,000 level. Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah, he feels pretty confident, which is not to say that he's right. But I will say, but he, you know, you check the market before you build something.
Listen, look at all this publicity he's getting. I mean, for nothing else. You've just paid for it. You have paid for this for them.
I apologize for doing that because, of course, that's my reporter's arm's length from everything has just been undercut. But really, I mean, the thing is, I looked around. They can't divide. They can't say, here's this huge penthouse. Oh, we didn't rent it. We'll chop it in four. It's not possible with that space. They either rent it or they don't. And again, he feels, having looked at the market, that he can get it rented. One of the problems is if you get something like that sold, I'll find it in the public records or my competitors will find it in the public records. But if something like this rents, we'll never know because there's no documentation that goes into the public records. So they could say it's rented. I'll have no idea.
Well, Dennis Rodkin, for more, ChicagoBusiness.com. Follow him on Twitter. It's been a delight, as always.
Thanks, Elise.